Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey guys. Good morning. Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. I'm here weekdays, noon to 3 Eastern. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. I'm updating the links on my blog entry here today so that the links work instead of just looking like a link. They'll actually link. Join up the chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. If you want to hang out with the boys and girls in there, I've got a few people in there. Hey, guys. Someone was asking about Jesse Trinidou, and hey, man, are you getting him on the show or what? And the answer is, I don't know what other media he's doing, but he told me I gotta wait until the trial is over. But boy, oh boy, I don't know what's gonna happen. Can't wait to find out what happens, and then I can't wait to get Jesse back on the show to tell you guys about it. I guess it's too late now for anyone to care if, when and if the truth really does come out. But, well, it's still important whether anybody else thinks so or not. So, yeah, I promise to do everything I can to bring that story to you guys as I have it. In fact, I'll just rehash it right now for people who aren't familiar. And I'll do it very quickly. Government employees murdered a guy named Kenneth Trinidou in a prison cell in Oklahoma in the summer of 1995. And 99.99999% chance the reason that they did so was because they thought he was somebody else, Richard Lee Guthrie, who they had very good reason to suspect may have been John Doe number two, who helped McVeigh blow up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. And so they tried to call Kenneth's murder a suicide, but his brother, Jesse, is a lawyer. And a lawyer who wasn't going to let the government get away with what they did to his brother, not scot-free anyway. And so he's been suing him and suing him and suing him. McVeigh actually ended up writing him a letter saying, hey, I know why your brother was killed. They thought he was Guthrie. And J.D. Cash came to the same conclusion. They traced down all the leads, and they ended up finding the same story that had been found by J.D. Cash and other reporters since then. And that was that there's a bunch of Nazis out of Elohim City in eastern Oklahoma was the name of their little compound out there. And most likely they were involved in the plot with McVeigh. And the government decided to let them all go, mostly because they were all flip state's witnesses and undercover informants of one kind or another. And so it made the government look really bad. They knew all along that the plot was going forward. They had an ATF informant inside the FBI plot who called the whole thing. I don't know if it was really an FBI plot. In fact, it may have been done, may have had as a ringleader a guy named Andre Strassmeyer, who seems as though he was not really a Nazi at all, but was simply a government agent posing as a Nazi in order to whoop these guys up. Anyway, so right now, the latest stage of the trial, and he's already won wrongful death and pain and suffering and all those kind of damages against the government for what they did to his brother. But now he's suing under the Freedom of Information Act, and he's actually gone to trial in a Freedom of Information Act suit because he's shown the judge he has probable cause to believe that there does exist video of the actual bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building that has been suppressed all this time. It's detailed in Secret Service documents and other documents that describes a second man getting out of the truck. Just like the 24 witnesses who saw Timothy McVeigh that morning, all of whom saw him with somebody else. That's right, 24. And anyway, so Jesse's winning. Part of the problem, though, is he had an FBI source, a former FBI agent source, who didn't come to the trial. And who, Jesse says, told him that he was threatened, that he would have his pension taken away, et cetera, if he came to the trial and told the truth. So the judge has said he is ordering the FBI to do a full-scale investigation, well, whatever level of investigation, to see whether there's any truth to that or not. He wants to see this witness in his courtroom. And then he wants to hear what this witness has to say. And what this witness has to say, apparently, is that he was part of the PatCon operation that predated even Waco and perhaps even Ruby Ridge. I'm trying to remember now. But anyway, it was short for Patriot Conspiracy, and it was the FBI's move to infiltrate the radical right. And so anyway, this guy apparently had some testimony. I forget what all now on the details. But he didn't show up in court, so now we're at this stage where we're waiting to find out the FBI's investigation into themselves to see whether they threatened him with his pension or not, and to see whether he's going to testify or not. So anyway, it's a very important story. Because, well, to me, I'll tell you the importance of it to me in, and I've told this story before, I know, but it's probably been a few years since I told this part of it. I was in high school, I believe I was a senior, let's see, yeah, 95. So I was a senior in high school, and I went over to my friend's house for lunchtime, and there was a, you know, friend of a friend over there who was Marines Force Recon from the Vietnam War. And I had talked to this guy a lot, and he was a serious-ass warrior from Vietnam. And he just said there were bombs inside the building immediately. And he pointed out they were here, here, and here, you know. And they had been watching it all day and said, yeah, that's what they were saying. But then they changed the story and said, no, it was in a car out on the street. But look, here, here, and here. Now, I'm actually more skeptical of that now than I ever have been. Although I still think there's a very good chance that there really were demolition charges inside the Oklahoma City Federal Building. But in any case, I've been... unbeliever of the government line on the issue from the very day that it happened. And there were a lot of people who saw through their nonsense. And because the you know, kind of populist patriot right took the rap for it, they were most interested in what really happened. And so you had a lot of, you know, militia types and John Birch types saying, look, it was these Nazis who did it. And they were right. They were right. And so... for me, what this has always represented is, well, what it represented back then was, holy crap, I guess the Illuminati really does rule all, or else how do they get Dan Rather to keep his damn mouth shut about this? How do they keep the whole, the entire media and the entire Congress to just go along with one guy did it? His closest accomplice was two states away at the time. Come on. And now I don't really believe all my ultimate conclusions then, but it does really, I think, provide a great window into, you know, public corruption and the power of elite consensus. If the Department of Justice decides that McVeigh is the guy they want to prosecute this and that you're a dick, if you say that there's anything else going on here that needs to be known, then that's it. That's all it takes to get every single newspaper publisher in America to fall in line behind you. And in fact, you know, the AP would do entire like 7,000 word stories about the ATF informant who had infiltrated the plot and had warned about what was happening, and then how the ATF was called off on their mission by the FBI. We'll handle it, the FBI said, and then didn't. And then, but oh well, no follow up, no importance. Doesn't matter. You can sit and read a 7,000 word article by the AP from 1998 or whatever, getting it right. But oh well. History has not been updated to reflect that fact whatsoever. No hearing was held. The biggest terrorist attack, obviously 9/11 makes it pale, but the biggest terrorist attack in America ever, the biggest mass casualties since, you know, second wounded knee or first, or I don't know. Huge. I mean, the Oklahoma bombing was just the most traumatic thing of the whole 1990s. It was the O.J. Simpson murders times a million, and every, you know, right-leaning gun owner in America was held responsible for it, and the Branch Davidians, who had all been murdered 2 years before, were held responsible for it, even though, of course, they had nothing to do with it whatsoever, since they didn't have time travel powers or anything. It's the hugest thing in the world, and yet they completely got away with the cover-up. absolutely and completely got away with the cover-up, never held a single hearing in Congress. 28 blacked-out pages on 9/11? There are no pages to black out on Oklahoma City. How do you like that? Not a single hearing held ever. Oh, okay, years later, Rohrabacher held some red herring crap about Iraq or something, but never the truth about the Nazis who did it and the FBI cover-up, allowing them to skate free. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Me. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I never understood why everybody would keep their stuff on Apple servers anyway. What is a cloud except a fancy name for a hard drive at somebody else's place? Why don't you keep all your data at somebody else's place? I admit, I got that Carbonite mess, which you should not get. You know, after your first 100 gigs, then they throttle your bandwidth down to 28K or whatever. It took me almost a year. It took me 9 months or something to complete my original backup on Carbonite. So, horrible product there. There's got to be another way. But anyway, point being that I only put my radio show archives there. I don't put all my personal stuff, you know, family pictures and whatever, on some cloud on somebody else's server. And certainly not naked pictures of my movie star girlfriends. Anyway, funny how everybody knows that we live in this age of electronic insecurity, but nobody really changes their behavior to reflect that, do we? I guess not so much. I don't know. Anyway. So that's my coverage of the hacked naked lady picture scandal. If you want to hear more about it, tune in somewhere else. Today on the show, we're going to have Gareth Porter on to talk about the Islamic State. Now, usually, I don't ever interview anybody just because of who they are. I only go by what was their last article that they wrote that I want to talk with them about. It's easier that way for me. Well, and it gets to the point. But Gareth hasn't written anything about the Islamic State, but you know what? I want to know what Gareth has to say about the Islamic State. I know it's going to be along the lines of, stay the hell out of there. But, I want to hear it. Good old Gareth Porter. And also, Robert Naiman is going to be on. He's a great liberal critic of Israel. I'm not sure if he's Jewish or not. I'm not sure if it matters. I guess it sort of kind of does matter. I don't know if he's a liberal Jewish critic of Israel or if he's just a liberal critic of Israel, but he's a good critic of Israel. And he's got this, I don't want to tell you all about it, but he's got a great article that I want to interview him about. Good old Robert Naiman. And then I got a couple of few other invites out. I don't know how likely they're looking, really. Well, I'm really hoping to hear from Dar. He's got a piece that's not about Iraq. It's about the Israeli kidnapping and torture of this lady and all the horrible things they did to her and how, let's see, I didn't even get a chance to finish reading it, honestly, but I could during a break real quick if I knew he was coming on. Tortured and raped by Israel, persecuted by the United States. She's living in Chicago now, and they're trying to come after her on immigration charges because the Israelis who tortured her and her father have made up these lies about her and what have you. Anyway, I don't know all about it, but I sure am hoping we can hear back from Dar Jamail on that issue. Unfortunately, I don't have his phone number anymore. All I got is his Skype contact. Let's see if he's online. Nope. All right. Well, we're trying. I emailed him. So there you go. And then also got an email out to the great Doug Bandow, although he's going to be making the same case as Gareth, so that might be kind of redundant. And then Ray, I think he's traveling. I'm not sure if we're going to get him or not, but I wanted to ask Ray about this open letter to Angela Merkel that we published at antiwar.com. So that might happen. I don't know. But anyway, I still got a ton of other news to talk about here. Oh, man. There's so much. I don't even know where to begin. How about the Islamic State? Now, how about this? How about you should know that this was written. I don't think I have anything real smart to say about it. I mean, I understood what he was saying, and I'm sure not in favor of any kind of international organizations or even national governments, actually. But I don't have any kind of real smart analysis of it, but it's at least worth a read so that you know who your enemy is and how he thinks. Henry Kissinger on the assembly of a new world order at the Wall Street Journal. And now, it doesn't seem to be any kind of really code word for one world state under the United Nations or, you know, world federalism or anything like that. I mean, he is talking about the contradiction between having a single world economy at the same time that we still have a world of 190-something nation states and how contradictory, you know, that can be sometimes and what have you. Although, I'm not really so sure what he proposes to do about it other than let's work harder at creating more WTOs and that kind of crap, you know? I mean, it's a very pseudo-world government, I guess, if you want to put it that way. And then, you know, I'm sure, I actually didn't read this very carefully. I'm sure that, you know, most of this is really just about trying to find excuses to maintain American hegemony in the name of global security, of course. Same thing since World War II always has been, but. So, yeah, I mean, he basically just ends with some rhetorical questions and stuff. Like, you know, his only real worry is that no one in D.C. is even thinking of the long term at all anymore. What do I have to get the Rockefellers to pay you people to think more than a couple of weeks out, huh? I don't do a very good Kissinger accent, but that was my Kissinger accent. What do I have to get Rockefeller to pay you people? He's got a new book coming out, World Order, it says. I couldn't stand to read a whole Kissinger book, but anyway, it does seem interesting to me that, well, the world is in crisis because America made it that way. And now the American crisis makers are trying to figure out what the hell they're going to do about it, or how they're going to exploit all the crises they created in order to excuse their further crisis creation. It's sort of the name of American foreign policy, you know what I mean? Anyway, so that's worth a look, and they'll let you pass the paywall on this one at Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal website. Henry Kissinger on the assembly of a new world order. The concept that has underpinned the modern geopolitical era is in crisis, he says. And I actually sent the link on to Justin. I'm hoping that Justin will write about it because that's Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com. Because being a libertarian, that means he's good on open trade in a global economy and as much integration as possible to paper over nationalist differences that people have that can sometimes lead to very terrible conflicts. And so, you know, that whole thing from Frederick Bastiat about where goods do not cross borders, soldiers will. There's a lot to that. And there's a lot to, you know, free trade between people, not just as their inherent right, but also in a utilitarian sense. Get these nations interdependent on each other, the different nations' economies interdependent on each other as much as possible so that they don't go to war with each other. Hey, man, you can't attack China. We'll lose billions if you do that. Don't do that. Otherwise, it could be fun for a bunch of warmongers to go and pick some fights. And anyway, so, but of course, then Justin is the complete and total anti-interventionist who opposes the UN, I think. He opposes the existence of the UN and the WTO and all those kinds of things. And so, you know, I think it'd be interesting to hear his so-called libertarian realist take on what Kissinger's written here. Oh, man, it's already the break again? Hey, as long as it's the break again and I got no time, let me tell you one thing real quick. Go and look up this by Richard Perle. Thank God for the death of the United Nations. From 2003. And it's not written by libertarians, it's written by an evil neocon. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Robert Naiman's going to be on the show, and so is Gareth Porter here in a while. I had a ton of cop news, police state news. Got strikes in Somalia. NSA type news. Of course, Ukraine. Iraq and Syria, that's really one story now, but it's a hell of a big one. I hardly know where to begin. How about Obama notifies Congress of ordering more airstrikes, this time in Iraq's Amirli? They spell it differently in different places. President Barack Obama formally notified the U.S. Congress on Monday that he had authorized airstrikes and humanitarian airdrops over the weekend in the Iraqi Shiite town of Amirli, where Islamic State militants had trapped the civilian population. Iraqi security forces, backed by Shiite militias on Sunday, broke the two-month siege of Amirli and entered the northern town after the U.S. military carried out airstrikes on militant positions and delivered emergency supplies to residents there. Now, if you check them out on the map, Amirli is, I think it's north, a little bit northeast of Baghdad. Right around the line of the eastern border of the Islamic State, still to be determined. Obama said in a letter to congressional leaders he was notifying Congress of his decision under the longstanding War Powers Resolution, which gives presidents authorization for temporary military action. That is a lie. That is an outright lie in the text of this news article by Reuters. Go and read the War Powers Resolution. It does not give the president the authority to start wars. It gives him the authority to respond to attacks. But even then, he's got to get permission from Congress to continue after 60 days. In this case, America's been bombing Iraq for much longer than 60 days, and all the president is doing is notifying Congress that this is continuing to go on here. Even Rachel Maddow, I hear, because I don't watch that show, because I would sooner blow my head off with a shotgun. But, I mean, seriously, I picture her face, and it makes a shotgun appealing. I mean, not that I would point it outwards at anyone, but, you know, just, no, I can't watch that show. But I read somewhere that even she is good on, hey, Obama, you have to get congressional authorization for this, because you do not have the authority to do this. Only they do. But anyway, you know, not like there's any such thing as a rule of law in America or anything like that. And who knows how good on it she really is. Probably if you said, yeah, but what about the UN Charter? She would say, oh yeah, that's right. So never mind. Even though there's no UN authorization for this either, but whatever. You know, a friend of mine emailed the other day, said, look, Scott, you called it. Now it's the Turkmen. And that's who lives in this town. They're Shiites, but they're Turkmen. And you know what? There was this great article from back in like 2004 or 2005. And I remember it because I had emailed it to a friend and used the subject line. The direct quote was, of course, it's the radio. So what the F is a Turkmen? Was a quote from a U.S. Army, I think, infantry officer. Who was being told, yeah, you know, your job here is to protect these Turkmen and these Shiites from these Sunnis and this and that. And he says, what the F is a Turkmen? Like, yeah, this is the social engineering force that we sent to remake Iraqi society. A bunch of well-armed 19-year-olds who don't know anything at all about the country they've been occupying for 2 years at that point. And, you know, I went and Googled that. And I couldn't find it anywhere. That's the thing about the web. Sometimes things really do disappear. I don't know. I couldn't find it, but I just thought it was funny. I remember joking about it with a friend back then. They're like, yep, this is our war force. We're still doing airstrikes on the capital city that we supposedly conquered and pacified 2.5 years ago. And then here, you know, we got people have no idea even the fact of the societies that they're erasing from the face of the planet. The Chaldean and Maronite Christians whose societies in Iraq go back 2,000 years, who have ceased to exist now. But anyway, point being that, yeah, hey, listen, man, I told you, if they got to protect the Yazidis, then they got to protect the Turkmen. And if they got to protect the Turkmen, then they got to protect the Christians. And if they got to protect the Christians, of course, they got to protect the Shiites. And what about the Sunnis? Why should the average Sunni Arab Iraqi have to suffer under the Islamic State just because they are basically the neighborhood that's been conquered? You know, they didn't vote. And even if they voted, I don't believe in democracy and popular sovereignty. I think that's, you might as well believe in, you know, whatever kind of superstition if you believe in popular sovereignty. By what magical process do you decide that I grant government authority over me? Because of the fourth phase of Jupiter or something? What is that? Nonsense. But anyway, they haven't had anything like the slightest form of a plebiscite, and I bet if you polled them and they, you know, could get away with answering honestly, they would say they don't want to live under the Islamic State. And after all, the Sunni Arabs, they're a minority in Iraq, aren't they? And so if the only casus belli is bad things are happening at the hands of the Islamic State, then I don't know what to tell you guys other than these guys are going to continue committing atrocities. I mean, they are war criminals. They are madmen. And all the propaganda about the Islamic State trying to get us back into a war there, at least, you know, much of it, all the, you know, babies on bayonets and the rest, you can more or less take to the bank. I mean, they lied about the siege on Mount Sinjar and all that, blew that way out of proportion. But, you know, it's not like the war party won't lie. But on the other hand, you're not going to have to look long and hard to find atrocities committed by the Islamic State. These guys have been crucifying their enemies to death for a year and a half already. Yeah, crucifixions, really. And all kind of beheadings and all kinds of, you know, lining people up and mass murdering them just for being Shia. And they really are, like, pretty freaking bad. You know, Patrick Coburn compares them to the Khmer Rouge and says, like, yeah, I mean, basically their entire thing is fighting. They don't really have much to do other than wage war. And, you know, hey, war is the health of the state. Unless you really lose, then you lose. But otherwise, being surrounded by enemies is pretty good for the Islamic State, just the same way as Nouri al-Maliki didn't mind provoking, you know, Sunni attacks against Shia in the run-up to the elections in April because he got to try to portray himself as the protector of the Shia against the Sunni. Same way everybody rallied around George Bush after the greatest failure of any American political leader in history. Same reason people rally around Obama now. And anyway, so there you go. Got to protect Erbil. Got to protect Baghdad. Got to protect Amirli. Speaking of which, we're not going to let there be a safe haven for this terrorist group. That is a blank check for war. And everyone's making such a big deal about the fact that Obama has said he has no strategy, doesn't know what to do. Well, there are no good options of what to do. But these are the Democrats we're talking about. They're going to do something, and it's going to be horrible. It's going to be horrible. And I don't know, man. I would like very much to believe that, hey, here's a president who's already a lame duck, but he still has a few years in power here, and he's already going to be left with the legacy of high treason for backing al-Qaeda in Syria this whole time. Does he really want to make matters that much worse? Is it possible he's going to use his own analysis and be hesitant, even his own cowardice, and be hesitant to get us further involved here? I don't think we can count on that. I think all the pressure on him is to go back to war, no matter how bad all the options are. These goddamn segments are too short, man. 4,800 killed in Iraq during August, reports Margaret Griffiths at antiwar.com/updates. 4,800 in the last month. More bad news on their side this break.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I promise Gareth Porter's coming up in just a few minutes. Then Robert Naiman later on in the show. And, man, I don't know. I got so much news. Let me talk about the police state for a minute. Let me get back to ISIS with Gareth. Now, I almost can't believe it, but yeah, of course I can believe it. What the hell? These protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, woke up the other morning to find a noose at their campsite. I don't know. I guess it wasn't up in the tree. It was laying on the ground. Anyway, I don't know exactly what happened, who put it there. But I'll tell you what, though, man. You look at this picture of these three young men, and it doesn't look like a hoax to me, man. The guy on the left is just mad as hell. The guy in the middle has a look on his face. He's the one holding it up, and he's just, like, incredulous. Man, can you believe this? And then the guy on the right is just like, damn, dude, I can't believe this is what's happening over here. You know, like, more sad than angry. But you look at their three faces, they don't look like they're faking to me, man. Found a noose on the ground over there. Oh, there's only one solution to that. Every black man in Ferguson should own an AR-15 rifle. And then we'll see who comes around with nooses. Yeah, those Klansmen aren't so tough when they're getting shot at. In fact, I think it's irresponsible for the people of Ferguson to not be armed to protect their own rights. The government is not going to protect their rights. The government does not protect their rights. Who's going to be their security force if not themselves? And yeah, if you're black and you're in Ferguson and somebody comes and brings a noose to your property, that's a credible threat of death. Shoot them with your AR-15 rifle. Or I don't know, maybe shoot to a wound because it's credible but not necessarily immediate. But then again, no, yeah, it is, dude. Yeah, it is. At least if I'm on the jury, it sure as hell is. Unreal. I don't know, man. I feel so old now. You know, I looked in the mirror, I was like, what, do I got glitter all over my face somehow? What happened? And all that had happened was I had shaved and my whiskers were starting to grow back out a little bit, and all the gray ones are sparkly when they're really short. I've got sparkly whiskers. That's how old I am. I got gray hairs growing out of my face. And yet, when I was a kid, I was raised to believe that, oh, no, no. See, we did this whole thing where, not that it's eradicated or anything, but society agrees now with Martin Luther King's, you know, one ringing statement that everyone held on to forever, which was, you judge people on an individual basis by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. That's been a real problem, but now we're trying to not be that way, at least. And that was what I learned when I was a tiny little kid, which was a long, long time ago now. I'm finally beginning to accept. But then, yeah, no, I guess, you know, fits and starts, huh? It's the cops who are the worst in all these cases, but those cops come from those, you know, adjacent neighborhoods, don't they? Amazing. All right, and then here, let me just go through this quickly, man. The Liberty Crier does such a great job. Trevor Lyman, he's my cheat sheet, man, on when it comes to this stuff. Of course, there's Cop Block and the Free Thought Project and Will Grigg and Radley Balco, and there's lots of great people doing great work on this, but Trevor Lyman's my cheat sheet because he arrives in my email box every morning for me. I don't have to go anywhere to look. Officer to citizen, you must be doing something wrong if you invoke your rights. Yeah, of course that's what he thinks. I remember that was an old quote from a long time ago. It was from like the 70s with some cop saying, when I hear someone talking about free speech or peaceful assembly, I think to myself, well, that man is a red. No real American goes around talking like that. Free speech? What do you have to say? You should be too busy working, boy. Ever been to jail? Cop points gun, threatens to kill citizen in response to cell phone recording. Yeah, that's right. Here it is at libertycrier.com. You can watch in Boynton Beach, Florida. Cop points his gun at this guy's head. Says, turn off the camera. Immediate credible threat of death for filming him. Man, why are these all not refreshed? Aren't they all refreshed? They should all be refreshed. God damn it. Officer who killed himself was part of a ticket rigging internal investigation. I think my only comment there was that's the closest thing you're going to see to accountability in an American professional police force is the possibility that the grand jury might indict a cop for something and then they panic and shoot themselves before the grand jury can return the no bill. Indict a cop for killing or stealing or committing a crime? Yeah, right. What is this, a storybook? Haha, stupid cop is so stupid. He thinks he's going to get in trouble, so he punishes himself. And way overdoes it, too. You know? Death penalty for stealing? But that's what cops think, right? Cops think it's okay to kill somebody for stealing. They even kill themselves over stealing. They're really corrupt. They don't have souls. They're just murderers. FBI's facial recognition system is a privacy nightmare that collects your data even when you've never broken the law. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to read this. I think I saved this because I wanted to get back to it. Wow, this is great. Who wrote this? Where did this come from? Source. Oh, EFF. Man, I got to get these guys on. This is a great article. I'm sorry I hadn't looked through this before. EFF.org. FBI plans have 52 million photos in its NGI face recognition database by next year. So there's your keywords. FBI, 52 million photos in their facial recognition. So very soon, and you've seen this coming for a long time, even if you're not a political paranoid, you at least have seen your Tom Cruise movies. And remember in Minority Report where every camera everywhere takes a picture of your retina or your iris. Identifies you all day, every day, wherever you go. People are getting black market eye transplants so they can go from here to there without being tracked by the all-powerful state. They're working on it. Only the old law, you know, the Bill of Rights, could have stopped it, but nobody cares about protecting it, preserving it, shouting, screaming, and freaking out, hell no, every time anyone tries to encroach on it. And so, it's only a matter of price now. How long before the facial recognition technology is all inexpensive enough where it can be deployed on those Minority Report levels? That's the only thing we're waiting on now. Here's another story about Jeff Mazansky, and I don't think I've ever interviewed anybody about this, but I see stories about it from time to time. He's doing life in prison for pot. For being a low-level pot dealer. He was not any kind of even regional operator, whatever. Had a couple of pounds at a time, something like that. Got busted 3 times. And so here he is doing a life sentence, a real life sentence in Missouri for pot, for trading in pot. He was never accused of selling it to kids. He was never accused of, you know, robbing someone with a gun in a bad pot trade or anything like that. He was just some guy. He's doing life right now That is how arbitrary the so-called rule of law is in America. It's a joke. It defines itself as a hoax. It's not a joke in any kind of harmless way. It's a hoax at the expense of all of us regular people who have to suffer under the tyranny of the state. Like this lady, again at Liberty Crier, Dayton, Ohio. Cop absolutely beats the crap out of a woman. Grabs her, she's up on a bench. He grabs her by the here's the video. Of course, they all lied about it. They're all guilty of perjury. All five of them who are standing there in the room. Guilty of the felony of perjury about what this one cop did, especially grabbed her by the back of the head. She's already up off the ground. He didn't body slam her. He slammed her face first into the ground, her entire weight plus his strength plus distance from the ground. He's lucky he didn't kill her. She's lucky. He wouldn't have gotten in any trouble. In fact, he's probably in more trouble because she lived to tell the tale. That's again at LibertyCrier.com. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
Oh, no. Well, it says here, guys, that ISIS has just released a video claiming to show the beheading of another American journalist, this time Stephen Sotloff, the guy who was threatened at the end of the last video. All right, well, we got Gareth Porter on the line. He's an independent historian and journalist. Writes primarily for Interpress Service, ipsnews.net, ipsnews.net, and he's done award-winning jerk. He's a real jerk. No, he's done award-winning journalism for truthout.org, and he's the author of the book Manufactured Crisis, debunking all the crap you've ever heard about Iran's nuclear program. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. I'm fine. Thanks for having me back again.
Very happy to have you here. Sorry that I can't talk right. Don't know anything, but I'm trying. I don't even know where to begin. There, I got my ISIS section over here in Mozilla Firefox is about 25 stories long. We got airstrikes all over the place. We got a war on the line between Kurdistan and the Islamic State, between Shiistan and the Islamic State. We've got ISIS... winning, it seems like, some pretty major victories over there in Western Islamic State land and was formerly called Eastern Syria. And we got the Peshmerga and the PKK commies and we got another beheading. And I just wonder what you make of all of this. What do you think's really happening? Where do you think it's all going? What the hell, man?
Well, first of all, Scott, I have not been primarily following the saga of ISIS and the U.S. Sort of segue into war again over the issue of its rise. The last month and more, I've been focusing almost entirely day to day on the issue of Israeli war crimes in Lebanon and then in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And so I've just barely, caught up in the last maybe 2 weeks with this story. But still, I don't feel like I'm by any means well read on the subject. But you're absolutely right to focus on this. This is clearly an issue that is going to be at the center of the whole debate on U.S. military involvement in the world for the next few years. I'm afraid to say.
Well, let me interrupt you for just a moment to say I can't wait to read your new long-form piece about Israel-Palestine, and I'm very grateful that that's been your focus. It needs to be. On the other hand, I also want to defend you from your own disclaimer, because as people may or may not be aware, you know a hell of a lot about what's been going on in Iraq over the last decade and what's led up to the rise of the Islamic State. And in fact, you know, you haven't been writing all about the Syrian civil war and what's been going on in Western Iraq for the last couple of years. And yet at the same time, I know that you really know a lot about it and have a lot to say about it anyway. So you don't have to be, you know, Coburn or Prothero actually reporting from Iraq to say something useful about it. Certainly not you.
Well, you're being more than kind, Scott. But in, you know, the fact is that, you know, I'm speaking here, you know, not as an expert, but as somebody who has thought a lot about the broader subject of U.S. Militarism and the problem of rationales for war, as well as the problems that, you know, any policy involving use of force, from my point of view, is going to pose for the interests of the American people. So that's really the fundamental frame that I just want to put this conversation in.
All right, well, go ahead.
Yeah, so having said that, you know, it strikes me that the issue of the rise of ISIS with such terrific ambitions and with such momentum that they have achieved over the last few months is in some ways almost the perfect storm as far as those of us who are attempting to argue that the United States should pull back from activist military involvement in the world. You know, one can conjure up very easily a scenario in which the ISIS phenomenon continues to grow, you know, like a sort of proverbial row of dominoes falling, or a bandwagon effect, I think even more perhaps is in order in describing the possibilities here. One can imagine that that in Lebanon and Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East, you will have a lot of people saying, well, this is the future and we should align with it, if only for sort of our own safety. And so in that sense, you know, one can view this as perhaps the most persuasive argument for the need for the use of military force by the United States compared with anything else that we've seen. I mean, you know, there's simply, from my point of view, there's no comparison between the argument in favor of war against ISIS compared with, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, whatever other use of force you want to cite over the last decade and more.
Right.
So I'm, you know, if you look at it from that point of view, and I think that is the right way to pose the issue of ISIS and in U.S. policy, then I think we have to start asking, you know, really fundamental questions. I mean, one of them that I would start with, not perhaps the most important, I mean, these are not in order of importance by any means, but the first question that I would mention is, you know, will the overall effect of U.S. Military force, starting in Iraq, but certainly potentially, you know, in Syria and elsewhere, will it in fact have the effect of stopping the ISIS phenomenon without, of course, doing such horrible damage that, you know, the overall effect from the point of view of U.S. interests would be clearly worse? And my answer to that is it's not clear. I mean, you know, I think we have to be very cautious about the idea that U.S. military force, basically the use of air power, is an instrument that is going to halt the progress and somehow cause the withdrawal or diminishment of ISIS power regionally, that's going to work. I mean, the entire history of the use of U.S. air power in wars that involve insurgents or wars that involve limited local conflicts is one that is not at all encouraging.
Hey, how about them? The history of them using air power in the Sunni Triangle, which did nothing but drive average Joe nationalist Sunni Iraqi into the arms of Zarqawi and the Islamist lunatic suicide bomber brigades in the first place, and created ISIS 1.0 back in 2004.
Well, absolutely right. And that, of course, is the first, the very first piece of evidence that I think needs to be brought forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it where, okay, let's say they just drop the entire damn Marine Corps into Mosul and Raqqa and just say, that's it. We're not letting you have an Islamic State. We're sacking your capital cities and we're driving you out of power. Well, still, all they've done is turn them back into an insurgency. They haven't gotten rid of them. Now they're just back in the same old IED war, or, you know, fighting the same old IED war they were fighting in 2006.
Well, and more to the point, I think it would not simply be that they would be set back but not defeated. It would create, obviously, I mean, you know, this is a no-brainer. It would create more political support for ISIS than they would have otherwise.
Right. All right, well, now there's a whole bunch of different directions to take this interview, and we're going to do as much as we can when we get back. It's Gareth Porter from Interpress Service talking about the rise of the Islamic State and what we would have D.C. not do about it. 1 minute. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the phone with Gareth Porter here. Independent historian and journalist from IPSnews.net, Interpress Service. Talking about the rise of the Islamic State and what we fear the Americans are going to do about it, kind of thing, it seems like to me. And I guess my basic bottom line, Gareth, is that it seems like they can't really do anything other than make sure that American citizens stay at the top of the list for bin Ladenites around the Middle East to want to kill. Otherwise, they got their hands full. They got plenty of problems. They're surrounded by enemies on all sides. Not that anybody's really invading to dislodge them, but still, they're pretty damn hemmed in. And yet, Obama seems to want to make it a priority that they stay focused on, you know, those of us who live between, you know, Atlanta and Portland. What the hell?
Well, let me come to this broader point that you just made about the regional context in a moment. But I want to go back to the first point for just a second.
Sure.
You mentioned the scenario of sending in the Marines. I think it's much more likely, of course, that what will happen is, at least in the initial phase, is that they'll send in the special operations forces.
Sure. Well, and that's already happening.
Yeah. Those are always the guys who are going to be called on to deal with this kind of problem. Now, you know, I don't have to tell you, but just to remind everybody listening, you know, the special operations forces have a record which is very well documented, and I'm proud to say that I've played a role in documenting this, of having a modus operandi that involves not hard intelligence, not vetted intelligence, but rather relying on essentially, you know, picking up phone contacts and stringing them together and finding out who talks to whom, and using that as the basis for targeting people for detention or killing. Now, you know, that is an approach that clearly is going to be very, very valuable in turning back the challenge of ISIS. I'm being obviously ironic there. This would obviously lead to disaster. And so I think we can be very confident that any ground presence of the United States, which is going to be sent into places like Iraq and Syria, or would be sent to Iraq or Syria, is going to lead to the kind of results that we've seen, particularly in Afghanistan, which has caused, I think it's really very accurate to say, the entire population, certainly of those regions where the special operations forces have been active, to become much more active and united in their hatred of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that was what they said as soon as Obama started bombing them. They said, you know, on one hand, excellent, this is perfect, thanks a lot, because look, everyone, we're fighting the Americans, which is great PR for them and helps rally more people to their cause. And then they said, oh, and by the way, we're coming to kill you. Thanks for reminding us how much we hate you and how much we blame you for everything going on around here, which is just, it's perfect from their point of view. If they can provoke America into invading, it's the same thing bin Laden was trying to do back in 2001.
And let us look at the other instruments that the United States has available to try to deal militarily with this situation. You've got drone strikes and you've got airstrikes. And, you know, I don't have to tell most people listening to this discussion that drone strikes as well as airstrikes are not just blunt instruments, but instruments that simply cannot discriminate at all. They simply do not do it. And certainly what would be required to be successful in this effort is precisely discrimination. That is, to be able to target separate out the ISIS activists, the ISIS militants, from the rest of the population. That is the part of it that we have the greatest difficulty with wherever we go to war, and in the Middle East. And you know, the reason is that we simply do not know what's going on. We do not have the intelligence. We have not had the intelligence anywhere that the United States has intervened militarily. And that's why you get special forces going off half-cocked and basically killing a lot of people who shouldn't have been killed, and, you know, entering their houses, doing what no sane person who understands Afghanistan would have ever done, to violate the sanctity of the Afghan home, and doing it hundreds of times every night. So I'll stop that little sermon. But I think the point I want to make in general about this is that the tools that we have at our disposal are so indiscriminate, not just by their nature, but by the historical evidence that we've already seen over the last decade in particular. Right. So that's why, you know, I think that the first point that I want to make is that this is really not going to work very successfully. But the second point I want to make does have to do with the regional context, and that is that the more the United States makes it clear that we are committed to using military force to stop ISIS, the less you're going to get the rest of the region actively involved in cooperating with one another to do something about ISIS. And, I mean, that's a very serious problem. I mean, I've forgotten now who the author of this recent commentary was, used the term learned dependence to characterize the habit that or the pattern of behavior that has developed over time in the Middle East among those states which have been allied with or have, you know, allowed the United States to have bases and in other ways have worked with the United States militarily. And so the more we contribute to that by basically saying, yeah, we'll take care of this, the less these countries are going to take seriously the necessity for making a lot of adjustments in their own policies, both regionally and in their own countries. Right. And I think that's a point that bears equal emphasis to, you know, equal to the point that U.S. military instruments do not work very well. Mm.
In other words, whatever decisions they might make to take care of this, we're just putting off them finally getting to it, and instead making matters worse for the medium term at least, and then waiting till maybe someday when we're finally out of there, the local power balances will finally work themselves out. That's really what the Declaration of Independence of the West means in the first place, kind of, right?
Right. And Saudi, I'm talking about you here. I mean, this is the main issue that I want to raise in regard to this whole problem of learned dependence and the necessity to get regional countries to take more responsibility themselves for doing things differently.
Right. Look. Well, listen, we're out of time for this segment. Let me keep you one more segment, can I? Oh, come on.
Okay, all right. I'll give you one more.
Yeah, yeah, because we still got a lot to talk about here, because there's a huge question about what the U.S. is not making Saudi Arabia do and stop doing here, Garrett, that I want to ask you about.
Sure.
And we'll get to it on the other side of this break. It's the great Gareth Porter, and you want to read his award-winning work on how the Special Forces kills innocents based on cell phone data. It's at truthout.org. Won the Martha Gellhorn Award for it back in 2011. We'll be right back in just a sec.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, those of you who listened to the interview podcast, you do know that all these interviews come from the live show, noon to 3 Eastern time at the Liberty Radio Network. You can find the whole show archives as well at scotthorton.org. All right. I'm talking with my good friend Gareth Porter, the best reporter in the world, my favorite. And he writes for Interpress Service and for Truthout, and he wrote the book Manufactured Crisis, which is the ultimate debunking of every lie, every innuendo, every piece of propaganda anybody ever put out about Iran's nuclear program. It's just great. He completely tells the whole story and gets it straight, and you know it. And anyway, so I think that's part of the reason that we have not had you to talk to about what all's been going on in Syria since 2011, Garrett. This, you've not made this your beat. To my terrible regret, it's been such a mess, and it's the kind of mess that you just rule at, you know, parsing and diving into. And so, but basically in a nutshell, I think it's fair to say, as Obama put it to Corporal Goldberg in, the Atlantic back in 2012, we're doing this to help take Iran down a peg. If we can weaken Assad, that hurts Iran, and that's why we're doing it, because that's what Israel wants, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, and by the way, you know, humanitarian concerns and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, even David Sanger, I think, as we could put it, has written for at least 2 years that all the arms and money were going to the jihadists all along. The moderates don't lead the fight. There are some sort of secularist type a little bit, but they're not the ones fighting. It's been al-Nusra's war all this time until ISIS split off from them. And it's been the American CIA, Barack Obama policy, I think. You correct me when you think I'm wrong here. Anything you want to, you know, disagree with. Their policy has been to work with and or, you know, not very plausible deniability, kind of turned a blind eye to Qatar and Saudi and Turkey. And they've even had, of course, you know, CIA intervention in Jordan, training up guys to wage this jihad. And they've had every reason to know that all along they are backing those sworn loyal to bin Laden and to Zawahiri. And then after April 2013 to the Islamic State, which is just as freaking bad or worse. And so, you know, that's really what's led to this crisis. You know, they had their own problems in Western Iraq anyway. And yet now it's led to this, where basically Al-Qaeda in Iraq, all grown up, is declaring itself a state there. And you mentioned Saudi Arabia and their role in this, but isn't Saudi Arabia's policy just whatever America's had them do this whole time? And you know, I don't even know what other questions I have other than, I guess, you know, anything you disagree with what I said. But is it treason?
I do have some degree of disagreement with the overall line that the United States deliberately channeled funds and guns to jihadists of the Al-Qaeda and ISIS school. And I think that it's more complicated than that. I mean, you know, without trying to get into the weeds on this, you know, I think what happened was that, you know, the administration wanted to get involved in bringing down Assad, no question about that. They chose as their instrument initially the FSA, the people who were, you know, certainly not the jihadists, but very quickly, you know, it became apparent that they were not cutting it, and I think what you see happening in 2012, 2013, particularly, is the administration pulling back from, you know, they were under pressure to you know, really put a lot more money and guns into Syria, and they did have this program on the border. There's no question about that, with the Turks' permission and collaboration. That was aimed at supporting opposition forces, but I think that by that time they were already aware of the danger that these arms were in fact going to fall into the hands of precisely the people who were even more dangerous than Assad. And I mean, there's a lot of information about that. So I think,
well, I wasn't trying to say exactly like what their motive was, but I got a clip of Hillary Clinton from 2012, from March 2012, saying, well, you know, Zawahiri supported the rebellion there. So are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? We got to be really careful because there's just a lot of bad guys. And yet we know she continued to push and push and push after that to continue to send arms there, knowing that, as she put it, there are no real people that we can work with to come together. We don't see these reasonable moderates that we can create a new government with. That's what she told CBS News in the beginning of 2012, and then they kept on, Gareth.
Well, I mean, I think anything that Hillary Clinton says is political, and I would hesitate to try to make sense out of it in terms of actual policy.
I mean, in context, she was defending herself from the accusation that the administration wasn't doing enough to support the rebels.
Yeah, exactly.
And she was saying, well, you know, it's kind of hard to support a bunch of people who are sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York.
Right. So I mean, I wouldn't want to try to make that evidence that the administration intended to actually, you know, support pro al-Qaeda or, you know, ISIS type jihadists.
Yeah, but intended is such a kind of weird word. What about they kept doing it, knowing all along that's what they were doing? I mean, I don't know. Who cares about exactly what they thought at the time? They kept doing what they knew was wrong.
I mean, I think that they were doing something very limited that my understanding is that they really were no longer running guns except to very, you know, a very, very selected group of oppositionists. And I think the real question that I would pose is related, but it's distinctly different. And that is, why did it take so long for the Treasury Department to identify the sources of funding for ISIS, which were well known by 2012, 2013? It was not until early last month, August 8th, that the Treasury Department finally put out a release that identified the individuals in the UAE who had been clearly funding ISIS for a couple of years.
Right. And, well, that's what I mean by not very plausible deniability. It's just, I mean, like when Ronald Reagan sold missiles to the Ayatollah. Sure, he had the Israelis give him the missiles, but people don't even really mention that because it's besides the point. Everybody knows that they were just the cutout.
Well, I'm not sure that's... You mean you're talking about the people who were funding ISIS were cutouts? No.
Yeah, for the American empire. What does Qatar and Saudi do that the Americans don't want them to do?
Well, I mean,
couldn't Obama have told the king of Saudi Arabia to knock this off back in 2011? No, he encouraged it this whole time and just shut it down last month, as you're saying.
Well, you have to make some distinctions here. First of all, I mean, the people who were doing this were not in the UAE government. They were prominent sheikhs. They were prominent political figures. No question about that. And, you know, my view, let me just answer my own question about why this, you know, why, in fact, Treasury Department didn't do anything about it. I mean, I think it has to do with the atmospherics during a period in which the United States, as you know very well, was putting all the emphasis on, you know, making sure the United States was doing, appearing to do enough to oppose Iran and its ally in Syria. And so in terms of the atmospherics, the United States didn't think the timing was right. I'm guessing, okay, that they didn't think the timing was right to come out with a statement that was blaming prominent figures in the UAE for their funding. But I think, first of all, it's clear that they were aware of it. I mean, Elizabeth Dickinson was writing about this and interviewing people in 2013 in the UAE and was putting out detailed analysis of this. And she herself, she's a journalist who wrote a very well-informed, very well-documented paper for the Brookings Institution on the funding for ISIS. And she said she was getting a shrug of the shoulders from diplomats, as she put it. So I agree with you that that's an indication that something was not right. But I do think that it's more, the problem is more complicated than simply saying that we were using cutouts there. I think that these are people who, I mean, first of all, UAE government is extremely weak, and these people were clearly operating independently of the government itself. This is pretty well documented that the government does not have control over prominent figures who are doing the funding. So it's more complicated, but nevertheless, I think that there's a real beef here with the Obama administration for not having made this an issue much earlier publicly.
Yeah, and you know, they didn't ever get rid of Assad, and I doubt that they were trying to take him down or Iran down this many pegs by creating an entire Islamic caliphate type state between Syria and Iraq. But you know, I wrote an article for the Future Freedom Foundation a year ago this spring, more than a year ago, saying, hey, look, I mean, lawless Western Iraq and lawless Eastern Syria seem to be pretty, you know, it's becoming that Islamo-fascist caliphate that George Bush and bin Laden always had as their fantasy, that they're really making this come true. So, and, you know, on this show, since, I mean, hell, the Libya war was before the Syria war, and we all know the Libya war was on behalf of militias that were mostly made up of veterans of the Iraq war who had fought the Americans. It was that clear back in 2011. We've been watching this like the slowest motion train wreck in the world leading up to the fall of Mosul and the rise of the actual Islamic State. That here, where Bush did the greatest thing for bin Laden ever by turning all the lands north and east of Baghdad into lawless jihadistan for all this time, Obama outright backed them and their Sunni-based insurgencies in Libya and Syria. And so it's not just, you know, they love to blame Nouri al-Maliki. And of course, you know, he's been horrible to the Sunnis of Iraq. But the reason that they had the Islamic State to turn to is because Obama has been helping this all along. And I don't know the degrees of wittingness or how one exactly qualifies or quantifies that. But since the dawn of the Arab Spring in Syria, it was so obvious that spring. I mean, we reported at antiwar.com that Prince Bandar and Eric Margolies had sources in French intelligence and whatever. This was being reported. It was in The Guardian that there's a Saudi-American CIA plot to support a Mujahideen war against Assad. We've seen this whole time. We've known that this was true. You know, since 2011, they've done this.
Let me address the wittingness question. I think that's a good term to sort of frame the discussion. In my view, we have to come back to the basics here. The idea that U.S. foreign policy is generally speaking based on sort of grand strategic theories or you know, grand strategy, fails to take into account the much more fundamental reality that every decision that's made by the national security state is made with the interests of the national security institutions themselves in mind. It doesn't have anything to do with sort of the desire to create a caliphate or, you know, a state somewhere in between, Iraq and Syria. These are grand strategy notions that are the results of, but not the cause of, the decisions that are made. I mean, if you look one by one at all the decisions that were made in Iraq and in Syria, I mean, you know, these were motivated by a combination of the bureaucratic interests of the military and the intelligence agencies on one hand, and the political interests of the White House on the other. I mean, you know, these are all short-term responses to situations where, you know, they don't even have to stop and think. They don't even have to calculate. They know automatically what decisions are going to advance the interests of the institution. And, you know, it's worth pointing out that the military, you know, understood from its point of view, its interests would not be served by going to war against Iran. We've talked about this many times. They were against going to war in Syria. It was political interests of the White House that were involved in Libya, that were involved in Syria, not the interests of the military. But all those things were short-term responses to situations, not grand strategy. That's my analysis, for what it's worth.
Yeah, no, it's worth a lot. And it's sort of a read 'em and weep kind of a thing, where I'm afraid to agree with you, but I think I do, that really, and this has kind of been one of the sub-themes on this show all along, Gareth, is that we really talk about what might happen and that kind of thing on this show to a degree a lot more than really takes place at the National Security Council, where everybody is just a suck-up to their boss, and that's it.
Exactly.
It's terrible. It's scary, kind of, because, you know, other than the great guests, there's not that much high-level talent or education on this end of the microphone, that's for sure. I don't speak one word of Arabic. You know what I mean? This is all very kindergarten stuff, and yet we seem to put a lot more thought into what's going on than they do.
I think that's right, and I just would add that, you know, these decisions have a bureaucratic political momentum to them. And so what happens is that decisions that are initially made to enhance the budget, to enhance the power of the institution, to give it more momentum, then have consequences which, you know, grow and grow over time. And they're committed then to policies that they cannot easily reverse, and that they don't have any incentive to recognize they've been making a mistake about. So all of these things play into, you know, what one sees now on the ground and in the air, if you will. And I think, you know, I mean, I can't explain, you know, the reports that you're referring to, which said, you know, there's no doubt the U.S. and Saudi, you know, have made a deal to support jihadists. My suspicion is that this was an obvious confusion between the people that they wanted to support and the people who took advantage of that support, at least in the initial period. That would be a logical consequence of the situation there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been kind of a mantra on this show, Gareth, that moderates don't fight. Moderates are a bunch of big fat expats at the hotel, and the guys who fight are the ones who don't mind dying. And when we're talking about a volunteer rebellion, Sunni-based insurgency like this, the guys who fight are the guys who are sworn to al-Nusra, the local bin Ladenite franchise. And then came ISIS, was the break-off from that.
Right. And yet still you get John Kerry swearing publicly that, oh, you know, our guys are getting stronger and stronger. Remember that one?
Yeah. He and Kerry, McCain and Kerry agreed that, no, the rebels are mostly secular.
Yeah.
Sworn testimony.
This was absurd, but from my point of view, you know, and I'm quite confident this is correct. I mean, what's really going on here is that they got committed to intervention in Syria, and they had to defend it, and as a result, they continued to tell lies, and you know, it got worse and worse.
Yeah. All right. Well, now, so I've already kept you way over time and through a commercial break and all these things, and I know you have more important things to do. But let me ask one more thing, which is, what's going to happen, Gareth? Predict the best or worst for me here, please.
I have no idea. I really, this is just too big and too complex for me to really have any notion.
All right, tell me this: do you think that the Army and the Marines want that land back? I mean, we talked in 2009 about how the Pentagon was saying, screw Obama, we're staying for 50 years. Iraq belongs to us. And is this their chance to go back? Are they over it now or what?
You know, as far as the Marines are concerned, I have no idea what their view would be. I mean, it's very possible that they would see this as an opportunity to come back from the dead. I mean, you know, the Marines are an endangered species. There's talk about getting rid of them. I mean, they're going to lose their mission completely. So, you know, maybe, yeah, they could see this as a way of avoiding that. I can see that possibility for sure. But let me just make one final point, if I may, which is really, in a sense, the most important point of all that I intended to make here. I was going to leave it to last because it was more important. And that is that, to me, the single biggest issue that we need to put up front in regard to the whole problem of military intervention to stop ISIS is the effect that this decision has on the future of the United States, of U.S. society. I mean, if we don't say no now, if we don't come up with the necessary argument as to why this is bad for the United States society now, for all the reasons that I know you and your listeners understand, then the situation becomes worse. It becomes more difficult in the future to reverse the momentum, to cut the national security state down to size. And so from my point of view, that is the single biggest problem, the single biggest issue, is to say no to an intervention that is perhaps the most persuasive argument of any that we've seen so far. Not primarily because it won't work, not primarily because it's going to cause the regional states to be, you know, to be more dependent on the United States, but because if we don't say no to this, we will lose for more and more years any possibility of reversing the power that has been centralized in the national security state, the resources that have been captured by the national security state, to the detriment of American society. And I think it's really a matter of the survival of this society, nothing less.
Right. No, I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, Tom Englehart has a new one today. He says, this is just the greatest saving grace in the world. I mean, you got to be a little suspicious that, you know, no matter what happens here, no matter how bad it gets, great. Further excuse to do worse, because here this guy, Baghdadi, might as well be Bin Laden reincarnate, only now sitting on top of something like an actual state coming together again. And it's, you know, like you said at the beginning, all the hype about Saddam, the terrorist state and whatever, is actually true about these guys. They crucify their enemies. They've beheaded another American journalist today. They've got an atrocity a day for the propaganda mill to try to, you know, just say based on how bad they are is why we have to stop them. Even though there are a lot of reasons to think that that's why we don't have to stop them, maybe.
And I can tell you, Scott, that the people who are most freaked out today in the Middle East and in the world about ISIS are located in Saudi Arabia. There's no question in my mind about that. That's where the greatest turbulence is happening and will happen with regard to this issue. Because don't forget that ISIS is a product of Wahhabism. It is the purest expression of Wahhabism, which is the underlying ideology of the Saudi regime and has been for many decades.
Yep. Yeah, the ultimate Frankenstein blowback. It's not even blowback. I'm coining a new phrase, Gareth. It's taken me a while to get it off the ground. I call it backdraft, like that Ron Howard movie with the firemen where you open the door and it's so hot in there, but once you provide oxygen, it explodes right in your face.
Yes.
Because blowback, that implies, as Chalmers Johnson said, consequences from covert action. So it's all kind of a mystery and people don't understand. This is just straight up, you know, lighting a firecracker and it blows up in your hand kind of behavior right here.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
There you go. I finally got something right. Hey, thanks so much for coming on my show again. I sure appreciate it, Gareth. You're the best, man.
Glad to be there. Thanks very much, Scott.
All right, y'all. That is the heroic Gareth Porter. He won the Gellhorn Award, Martha Gellhorn, over there in England, for his work at truthout.org, where he wrote up all about the SIM card cell phone data and how Petraeus and McChrystal used that to fight their Navy SEAL Delta Force war of KGB-style night raids on the people of Afghanistan and Iraq before that. Great work that he's done there for truthout.org. And then, of course, he writes for Interpress Service, IPSnews.net, and the book, buy the book. Even if you can't read because it hurts your eyes, give it to the local library. Buy the book. It's called Manufactured Crisis. The True Story Behind Iran's Nuclear Program, something. Manufactured Crisis by the great Gareth Port. Okay, cool. And the music's about to start playing, isn't it? There you go. Thanks, everybody, for listening to my show. We got to take a long break here, top of the hour news. When we get back, I got more bad news. And then the great Robert Naiman is going to be on to talk about Israel-Palestine with us. So hang tight. It's the Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Damn, stupid world's bumming me out, man. I don't know, dude. I wish I could have kept talking with Gareth. I guess I could have, but I was trying to be a tenth of the way polite and let him go. But yeah, man, so the real question before us is, how do we stop this from getting worse and worse? How do we put brakes on this thing? Oh, he's Hitler. Oh, he's Hitler. That's what they say every time. In this case, it's, you know, not that he's got a Germany to take over. Not by a long shot, okay? He's got the worst part of Iraq to rule is what he's got. But as far as cartoonish supervillainy to fill that spot where an actual casus belli might go, these guys fulfill the role pretty well. Go look at the Islamic State on Live Leak and watch them line up men by the hundreds and machine gun them all to death for fun. Yeah, they make great boogeymen for TV. You know, I was talking with Eric Garris earlier on the show, and he was saying, you know, all they're talking about is these three missionaries in North Korea. And I said, good. I mean, basically, you can't say anything about the Islamic State that doesn't sound like war propaganda. We're better off if CNN just ignores it. Because if they're talking about it, that means they're trying to manipulate your emotions to support war against it. And the polls already have Americans in favor of airstrikes. Ah, sure, bomb them from the air all day, but just don't send in ground troops. Oh, yeah. Just like, let's go get Saddam meant let's go stay for a decade and get 1 million people killed in a massive Shiite, pro-Shiite civil war. And create Jihadistan in the leftover territory of the country. Yeah, let's just do airstrikes. Well, I mean, whatever. I don't see any way around it. I almost don't even feel like trying. What am I supposed to do? What are we supposed to do, guys? I don't know what to do. How do you keep them from sending fleets of drones over there? You would need the American people. Like, you know what? It happened a year ago, man. It happened a year ago. They said, let's go to war in Syria. And the American people did not have a clear narrative that, like, hey, the people who are most against Assad are a bunch of suicide bomber bin Ladenite lunatics, and why in the world would we fight for them? I mean, Dennis Kucinich had the great quip that Obama wants us to be Al-Qaeda's air force. That was 100% correct at the time. That was exactly number one reason, utilitarian reason, why not to do it. And the American people, I don't think they really got that. I think mostly what they were being sold was, let's go protect the little Syrian people because they're being hurt. And the American people were so jaded, they said, no, we don't care if they're being gassed to death, right? It's not that they were suspicious of the gassing story that was later debunked. It's that they couldn't be made to care. Obama doesn't inspire enough confidence as commander-in-chief on the right. And the left was afraid of Obama getting us into another Iraq war-style occupation disaster. And then the British Parliament voted it down. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said, man, I don't really want to do it. We had a really great perfect storm against worse Syrian intervention last summer, which could have led to the fall of Assad and an ISIS takeover of the whole damn country all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. Is that what you want? But anyway, that's what we need again, and we need it right now. And this is the worst nightmare ever, having to go back into the Sunni Triangle. And fleets of drones, fleets of F-18s from, I love this, the USS George H.W. Bush, the guy that swore to God this will not be another Vietnam. 24 years ago. Wait. Right? Yeah. 23. This will not be another Vietnam. Well, in the last half of the time that's passed, we've been bombing Iraq ever since, occupying it for a good, you know, half of the time. They've constructed an entire new aircraft carrier to name after this guy for us. So anyway, whether it's F-18s from the decks of the USS George H.W. Bush, or whether it's fleets of drones being flown from Kurdistan, or what have you, as long as America's intervening here, it's the path toward further and further intervention. I mean, Obama himself has already proven just how easily words, simple turns of phrase, can be used to escalate this war completely out of control. And, you know, he's announced since then that he's afraid and he doesn't know what to do and he doesn't have a strategy yet. And all this stuff, but he continues to intervene. But he said way back in June, right after the fall of Mosul, he said in a speech on the White House lawn in front of the helicopter that we will not allow there to be a safe haven for this terrorist group. You won't allow there to be a safe haven. I mean, at this point, they got a state. But like I was saying to Gareth, if the U.S. or some proxy army can sack Mosul and Raqqa, if Syria, if Assad can take back Raqqa, if U.S. Backed Kurdish and Iraqi Shiite forces can take Mosul, if the U.S. Marine Corps takes Mosul and Raqqa even, you still just turn them back into an insurgency. You haven't gotten rid of them. You just turn them back into insurgency, which is what they were on May the 30th. They were still the Sunni-based insurgency. I mean, they've been working on creating kind of a mini-state. But anyway, you can see how this is going to be a problematic problem, man. I mean, all those years of 2006, you know, in the end of 2005, they did a poll. The U.S. Army said they wanted to go. 75% said we should go now. There's not a clear victory to fight for and delineate and win. And this is crazy. It was their term. The U.S. Army grunts, the specialists and the privates and the sergeants, it was their term that, well, it's time to go out and play the IED lottery, right? There's no battle to fight in. There's no skill or loyalty or bravery or any part of your training that will help you. You're just off to go see if maybe today's the day that your body gets blown to little bits by a bomb hidden in the road. A homemade landmine. All right, off we go to play the IED lottery, they would say. You know, the surge, people talk about the surge working. Never mind that they never achieved the benchmarks. The major fighting of the surge wasn't even against the Sunni-based insurgency anymore. I mean, it was kind of the mopping up of al-Qaeda in Iraq with the help of the Sunni-based insurgency after they bribed the tribes. Most of the fighting of 2007 was against Muqtada al-Sadr, who is still one of the major leaders among the United Iraqi Alliance and supporters of the Dawa Party in power. The Americans, in other words, you had this coalition. And the Americans were putting that coalition in power in Baghdad, but outright attacking the leaders of one of the major factions of it and all the people who happen to live around there. There's a Washington Post reporter wrote a book called The Good Soldiers, where at one point an officer and at one point the author himself, I think it's Finkel, right? Or Filkins. I always confuse Finkel and Filkins. Anyway, the author himself and an officer is portrayed in one scene is kind of seeing the irony in this. Isn't it funny that we're fighting Sadr at the same time that we're actually, the rest of the army is cleansing Baghdad of the last of the Sunni for Sadr, fighting with him and with his allies in the Badr Brigade, destroying that Sunni-based insurgency. And, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, maybe more than 1,000 Americans died fighting that little microcosm of a war for nothing inside a war for nothing. Fighting against the guys they were fighting for the whole time. At one point, the author of the book, Good Soldier, says, huh, that is kind of weird, isn't it? Oh, well, anyway, back to the guys getting their legs blown off and this madness that accomplished nothing other than helping create the rise of this Islamic State in the first place. Crystal says, start the bombing. There probably won't be unintended consequences.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I appreciate y'all listening. Man, there's so much to talk about. And well, I do go on, don't I? I really should have a four-hour show, man. I just end up throwing away so many articles a day I never get to. It's sad. Listen, Robert Naiman is coming up to talk about Israel-Palestine with us here in just a few minutes. I really like him, man. He's a good writer, and yeah. Now, so let me mention, I'm at Voices of Liberty now. I think I need to get back with them because it doesn't seem like my posts are being updated there very well, although I haven't checked in a few days. Oh, let me look. I got a link right here. Let me see. Voices of Liberty. I think there's still just two posts here. Yeah, I need to get with them and update it. But anyway, this is Ron Paul's big new thing. It's like the Ron Paul Channel 2.0 kind of a thing. So I'm very honored to be participating in that. I really appreciate Ron Paul having me there. VoicesOfLiberty.com. And so hopefully that'll turn into a little bit bigger of a thing there. I think they're kind of just getting warmed up in that project. And then also I want to mention my two new sponsors. I didn't have everything ready to go in time to play the two new ads today. I got two ready, but one of them needs to be redone, and the other one I need to hear an okay on, so I don't know yet. But anyway, I cut two new spots for my two new sponsors. They're both books. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. He writes for us at antiwar.com from time to time. He's a counterpunch lefty, and us real-ass libertarians, we love counterpunch lefties. They love us, and it's important because opposing empire is the most important thing at all. And it's so most important that it outranks virtually all other considerations. And anyway, those guys are really good on a lot of things, too. And I really like this guy, Tom Harrington. He writes some great stuff. And the book is, again, Livin' La Vida Baroka. And then I have the whole damn title here in front of me somewhere, don't I? Wait a minute. The subtitle is American Culture in a Time of Imperial Orthodoxies. And it's some good reading, man. I hope you guys will check it out. You'll be hearing spots for it, hopefully start tomorrow here on the show. And then also Pizza Noir, which is a fun little fiction. This is probably the first fiction book I've read, and I don't even know how long. When was the last time I read fiction? I read the book of Episode 3 back in 2005. I admit that. I think that was the last time I read fiction. I don't know. Anyway, so I read fiction. And it was fun. I liked it, man. It was good. This is what it takes not just to get me to read fiction, but to read a book at all anymore, apparently, is you got to make an arrangement. I'll do spots on the show. I got to read a book before I do spots for it, though. So I guess every time a new book comes out, I should try to sell the authors and the publishers on buying spots on the show. That way I can read all the books I want to read because I'll have to. And then it'll be great. I don't know. Anyway. So, Pizza Noir, it's about a detective on a murder case, and it's a fun little thing. Book one by author Denver Day. You can find it at Amazon.com. You can find it at scotthorton.org/books right now, scotthorton.org/books. And I'll have both of those ads should be playing for you on the show tomorrow. And I would appreciate it very much if you would help support this show's sponsors. They're all great anyway, so they're all the types that you'd like to support anyway, so it shouldn't be too much to ask, I don't think. All right, good, thanks. And if you like it, you like it, right? Cool. All right, so there I took care of business. Now here, I swear to God, I'm going to spare you a whole thing. I have a whole thing about this, you know that. But I'm not going to give you the whole thing, I'm just going to give you the headline. You know it's true already. 71%, usually it's a bit higher than this, but yeah. 71% of the American people say that the country is on the wrong track. The wrong track. Well, that can mean a lot of things to 300 million different people, right? Well, I'm here to tell you the one thing that we all have in common. It's our national government. It's the problem. Particularly, its world empire. You know, Bill Clinton's professor, Carol Quigley, from Georgetown University, taught that world empire was the last stage of a civilization before it kills itself. And so you should be prudent and resist the temptation to, oh, say, I don't know, expand NATO all the way up to Russia's border. Invade and occupy and rule through dictatorship and proxies the millions of subject peoples of the Middle East. Pivoting to Asia, conquering Africa, because that's how civilizations die, biting off more than they can chew and choking on it, kind of a thing. And that's what's happening to us. Oh, I was going to spare you a whole thing. You know that that's the answer. It's the empire. The domestic and especially the foreign empire, which of course serves as the justification for the domestic one. We don't need them. We can be the USA, we can be America, and have a wonderful society without D.C. at all. For that matter, without any of our state capitals either. But anyway, we don't need them. They keep making everything horrible so that we think we need them. But they are the problem. The more you hate them, the less you are the demand for their supply. The less power they have. There you go. They're not your security force. They are your enemy. Okay. Welcome to reality in 2014. Appreciate it. What's wrong with America? Empire is what's wrong with America. All right, good. And then Somalia. Attacking Somalia again. It's one of the many countries that Barack Obama attacks all the time. And of course, we support the sock puppet would-be dictatorship there in Mogadishu. And in this case, they were going after, they claim... they were going after one of the guys from the mall attack in Kenya last year, and another Al-Shabaab leader. Apparently, where the hell are my Somalia stories, man? There it was. I saw Mali. Here, Somalia assessing results. How many people they say were killed here? I thought this was the article that had the number killed. Nope. I think I read... No, that's different. Anyway, you can read about it at CNN and a few other places. But you should know that the African Union occupation of Somalia is entirely paid for and mandated by your government. And that's the murderous Ethiopian army along with Burundi and Uganda and Kenya. And they occupy Somalia and they kill Somalis. And Ethiopia's invasion, backed by the United States, mandated by the United States back in 2006, is what led to the rise of the Al-Shabaab wannabe bin Ladenite movement there in the first place. And, you know, I think, again, like the Islamic State, if the foreigners, us, the U.S., if they would just stay out, then not everything would be perfect. But then we would see just how much natural power Al-Shabaab has. They don't have anything like the wealth or the strength to strong-arm the whole damn country. They only have as much power as local legitimacy grants them, and they only have legitimacy because of our intervention there. Still killing people. Type in my name, Scott Horton, FFF, Somalia, and read about the true consequences. 250,000 people dead. More. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for the full interview archive. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. A lot of whole show archives for you there, too. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. All right, next up is Robert Naiman from Just Foreign Policy. And this piece is at Common Dreams, commondreams.org. If liberal Zionism were dead, what actions would that imply? Well, that's a good question. Welcome back to the show, Robert. How are you doing?
Good to be with you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. First of all, let me just mention real quick here, because I didn't get a chance to earlier, and I just want people to know this stuff is out there and searchable. There's, I think, drone footage. Seems like remote control airplane footage of Gaza. That if people just look, if you Google aerial view of Gaza destruction, something like that, put that in your search terms, you can find the video. It's posted all over the internet, and it's really something, and just consider what all they claim about, you know, precision laser-guided this and that claims and bending over backwards to protect civilian lives. Apparently, they're just carpet bombing the place if you look at the results. And then also, there's this footage of IDF soldiers sniping children playing on a rooftop in the Gaza Strip. There's your search terms again, IDF sniping children and then laughing and mocking the child that they shoot in the leg, who limps away in terror, of course. And then I guess this headline can wait till the next segment, because I want to ask you about this too. But I want to get back to your article here. You can comment on anything I just said if you want, but otherwise, I would ask you to do like you do in your article and ask, well, just what is liberal Zionism? What's the crisis, and what difference does it make anyway?
Well, you know what I was trying to... So the context was, there was a piece in the New York Times that was widely circulated that said, you know, liberal Zionism is dead, meaning the sort of the liberal, you know, pro-Israel ideology that's animated such groups as the J Street and Americans for Peace Now, people who refer to themselves as pro-Israel, pro-peace, in support of two-state solution. And in the wake of the Gaza war, many people said, you know, wow, what happened to that ideology? It seems to be dead. And the article, which is, you know, obviously a very important set of questions, but then the article went on to say, well, the two-state solution is dead, and we should push in the direction of a singular binational state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean that has equal rights for Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. And when I was arguing my piece that, you know, while that might, as an abstraction, be an appealing ideal, it doesn't answer the more fundamental question of how we got to the point that we're at, which is the, you know, the whole reason that anybody was in favor of the two-state solution in the first place was not that they necessarily thought that this is, you know, the greatest thing that one could possibly imagine from the point of view of justice. It was that it seemed to satisfy kind of minimum criteria for some justice of the Palestinians, saying, okay, well, they can have their own state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. That's one. But two, it seemed realistic. It The idea was that international pressure, international support, including U.S. pressure, can compel the Israeli government to accept the two-state solution. And so what I was pointing out in the piece is that the asking, you know, is liberal Zionism dead? And then, maybe we should abandon the two-state solution, doesn't answer the question of why did it fail? And what should we therefore do? The fundamental problem, I argue, is not that this is a morally contradictory ideology that couldn't square the circle between the liberal values of equality and the Zionist idea of Jewish dominance in Palestine. The fundamental problem was that people didn't use liberal Zionists, two-state supporters, whatever you want to call it, didn't use the tools, sufficiently use the tools of political pressure that anybody else would use in any other context to try to bring about a realistic solution. A labor union, a women's group, environmental group would use the nonviolent tools of political pressure to force their demands. And that's what hasn't happened. There has not been a movement that used political pressure to force the Israeli government to change its policies. That's been the key failing. And we saw in the Gaza war that these groups first did nothing, and then, you know, were kind of anemic in their response and did not, for example, try to lobby members of Congress to say, hey, let's stop this violence with a ceasefire, or let's support a diplomatic solution that ends the blockade of Gaza. Two members of Congress did that, Keith Ellison and Barbara Lee. But if you look at the public discourse around this, hardly anybody is asking the question, gee, how come we only have two members of Congress to say this reasonable thing? Why don't we pressure other members of Congress to say this reasonable thing? It's we have not successfully directing pressure to winnable fights and using political pressure to bring that about, as every other organization or movement engaged in U.S. politics would do.
Right. Well, so in other words, it sounds like what you're saying is that MJ Rosenberg is basically out there as a one-man band. He's a liberal Zionist who's a two-state guy, very against the one state. He very much is for Zionism within 67 borders, but is basically hell-bent on you know, being at least mad as hell about it. I don't know if he has anybody to organize to really do anything about it. Instead, you know, we got J Street, and they really are basically, they're filling up that vacuum in a sense, but they're not really doing anything. They're not insisting, so, but why not? I mean, what are they in denial? Netanyahu, he'll do the right thing. He's going to give up the West Bank because it's obviously the smart thing to do. I mean, is that what they think or what?
No, I don't think they think that. I think that there is a taboo in the organized Jewish community against pressuring the Israeli government. And J Street is incorrectly deferring to that taboo when they need to be more aggressive in challenging that taboo. Yeah. And
I mean, for me, I don't have any connection to Israel really whatsoever. So, but I'm more than happy to say this is a suicidal policy. They're crazy to let Netanyahu and worse be their leadership up there. The sooner they give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the better, according to their own goals of maintaining this 80-20 Jewish majority inside Israel itself. Otherwise, everyone just shrugs and says, okay, really, you do rule all the land all the way to the Jordan River, and you're nothing but the Jim Crow South, worse than apartheid South Africa, and that'll be even, you know, less sustainable than the current mess. So,
right.
I don't know why people who really care about the future of Israel got to be so afraid to say what is obvious to anyone about what's best for the Israelis.
Right. So, I think the key difference, I mean, one way I think is that's really helpful to look at it from the point of view of understanding, you know, what would politically realistic organizing do, is let's compare two similar issues. U.S. policy towards Iran and the question of Iran's nuclear program and U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine. What do these two things have in common? They have in common that the Israel lobby, so-called, you know, American Israel Public Affairs Committee and its friends, are on the other side. So, yes, this is a huge, you know, 800-pound gorilla that is an obstacle to policy.
You know what? I'm sorry, Robert. We got these hard breaks, and we just got to take them. But we'll come right back and talk again about your analogy there about Israel-Palestine and Iran policy and the politics, the liberal politics of opposing these bad policies. On the other side of this break with Robert Nayman at CommonDreams.org and JustForeignPolicy.org. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Robert Nayman, and he runs JustForeignPolicy.org. Well, actually, that's not right. He runs Just Foreign Policy at JustForeignPolicy.org because it's more than a website. It's a thing. Also, he's got this great article at Common Dreams. It's called If Liberal Zionism Were Dead, What Actions Would That Imply? And I'm sorry, we were interrupted by the break there, Robert, when you were explaining, look at the difference in political activism on the question of the Iran issue and the Israel-Palestine issue, where the lobby clearly is hawkish on both. But so what's the difference on the other side?
So the difference is that people that want to have a different U.S. policy towards Iran, a policy of diplomacy and not war, a policy of realistic engagement to deal with the issue of Iran's nuclear program, have actually won in important policy fights in the last couple of years, despite the fact that AIPAC and the Israel lobby was on the other side, pushing towards confrontation and trying to undermine diplomacy. And groups like J Street and Americans for Peace Now were a key part of the coalition that helped bring that about, defending diplomatic engagement. So, for example, a key fork in the road, when the U.S. Agreed to an interim nuclear deal, the Obama administration agreed to an interim nuclear deal with Iran and was attacked by the right and AIPAC and the Israel lobby, J Street and Americans for Peace Now and other groups dove in with Congress, organized letters, bipartisan letters of Democrats and Republicans saying, no, we should not do more sanctions on Iran now. Let diplomacy work. Let the president's diplomacy work. Don't blow up U.S. diplomacy with Iran. And they won that confrontation, including, you know, bringing Democrats and Republicans along with diplomacy with Iran and against AIPAC. So a key question that we should be asking ourselves, if we could do that with U.S. policy towards Iran, why can't we do that for U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine? And I think a key answer is that these same groups that have been willing to be more aggressive and assertive in pushing on U.S. policy towards Iran have not been willing to do that with respect to U.S. policy towards Israel and the Palestinians. Like when President Obama said, okay, we're going to insist on a freeze in Israeli settlements in the West Bank to get negotiations going. These groups did not strongly back him up. They did not strongly go to members of Congress and say, okay, you need to speak up now for the president's diplomacy, because they were too shy to say, hey, you know, it's a good thing that President Obama is trying to take a firm line. Anytime any kind of daylight opens between Obama and Netanyahu, these groups, all of us, need to be get behind Obama and say, you know, or whoever the U.S. president is, doesn't matter, Obama, but Obama happens to be someone sometimes willing and carry, sometimes willing to have some daylight. We need to get behind that. Happened again with the question of ceasefire and the Israel-Gaza war, with Kerry, you know, coming out and pushing for a ceasefire to end the war and deal with the issue of the blockade in Gaza, which is a key thing that we need to end that war completely and stop violence in the future. These groups did not come out and solidly defend Kerry against the attacks from the Israeli right.
I don't understand why not. You know, as we talked about, the giving up of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip is absolutely of dire importance for the future of the Israeli state for the long term. They have to do this. It's life
That's
or
right.
death. Whereas the Iran nuclear issue is basically just a big red herring excuse to have a Cold War with Iran, as we all know, reading Gareth Porter as we do. And so,
That's right.
You know, what the hell is going on over there, J Street?
The difference is, you know, J Street and APN, the problem is not at the level of rhetoric. The problem is at the level of putting rhetoric into practice, because these groups have not been willing to really fight and organize in support of the policies that they claim to support. So, you know, for example, President Abbas goes to the United Nations to try to save the two-state solution and get diplomatic recognition for an independent Palestinian state, the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, gets attacked by Netanyahu and the right and the Israel lobby. And, like, where's J Street? Where's Americans for Peace Now? The, you know, J Street put out this convoluted statement saying, well, we don't agree with what Abbas is doing, but it would be bad if the U.S. vetoes its own position. This is not, this kind of, like, on the one hand, on the other handism isn't going to change the dynamic. These groups, you know, when Abbas goes to the U.N. and uses nonviolent diplomacy to push for a two-state solution, these groups need to come out, you know, four square and say, that's good. That's what we want the Palestinians to do. Use diplomacy, nonviolence, and politics to force the demand of the two-state solution, not this in-between triangulation on the one hand, on the other hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, I mean, we've really seen, I mean, it's been pretty obvious all along, but they kind of explored some of the background in that New Yorker piece of just how willing Netanyahu was to not just fight Obama, but enlist the entire Israel lobby to fight Obama on the settlements on Iran and everything else, and especially on Iran, where it really came down to. I mean, you talked about some of these groups were good and lined up behind Obama on the issue, but it really came down to him saying in the State of the Union address, basically, knock it off. Okay, I will veto this if you do it. I mean it. And they finally went, oh, okay. But it really came to that. And they were acting, basically, the Congress, both houses, both parties, as agents of a foreign power against the President of the United States.
Here's the thing,
that's what Netanyahu wanted. Ha! The guy's got Yahoo right in his name.
But here's the thing, Scott. When President Obama did that in the State of the Union, that was the final nail in the coffin. But prior to President Obama doing that in the State of the Union, these groups intervened with members of Congress to defend the administration's position.
Right.
So when Obama took that stand, he knew he was going to win, because
right.
the groundwork had already been laid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's these two things together. Yes, you know, Obama has to fight, but he's not the only person that has to fight. You know, the groups have to fight. Public opinion has to fight. So when Obama picks the battle, he wins the battle. And those two things go together.
Right. Yeah, you know, speaking of MJ Rosenberg, he told me on the show, I think he wrote it up in an article, and we talked about it in an interview at one point, about how in 2009, Obama really had Netanyahu on the ropes, and he was really going to give in and freeze the settlements and this and that. And that, I guess MJ said he had sources in Israel who told him Obama blinked one day early, that basically he had won and then woke up in the morning and snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. And he really could have made major progress towards a two-state thing then. And, of course, it was to balance on, supposedly, we'll get more cooperation on the Iran issue. Yeah, well, see how well that worked out for what it was worth.
Well, I think the important takeaway is that none of this is done. You know, President Obama still going to be president till 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Never has to run for election again. And, you know, we're going to have a congressional election. And then that's done. And President Obama, anytime he wants, and anytime the groups and public opinion is ready, can pick a fight with Netanyahu on this and win it. But people have to be ready for the confrontation and ready to win it.
So give them good advice about how to organize, how to participate in the groups that are good on this, or to pressure the groups, you know, whatever it is. What do people do to help you out here?
Well, so right now there's a fight going on. You know, Israel, the Israeli government just announced a big bunch of settlements. I actually have an alert in my email from J Street condemning the announcement and demanding that the U.S. take a harder line. That's exactly what J Street should be doing. But they also need to be pushing members of Congress to say that. Yes, the U.S. should oppose this, and it should really oppose it. Take a hard line in opposing it. Right now, talks are going on between Israel and Hamas in Cairo about a long-term, trying to get a long-term ceasefire in Gaza. In order for that to work, there needs to be diplomatic pressure to say, okay, we're going to end this blockade of Gaza once and for all. Groups could be doing that right now, saying, let's end this. You know, let's end this between Israel and Gaza like we ended it between Israel and Lebanon after 2006. Let's end the violence across the border. Let's end the blockade. That is achievable in the next month if there were serious political pressure to bring it about.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it is kind of a matter of herding cats or something. I don't know how AIPAC does it so well, and the Peace Party always has such difficulty with this. But there are so many, you know, liberals, Jews, and otherwise, who are good on this, who could be such a powerful force. So sure hope we see some progress. Thank you for your efforts, Robert. Good stuff.
Good to be with you.
All right, that's Robert Naiman, everybody. He's at justforeignpolicy.org, and this one is at commondreams.org. If liberal Zionism were dead, what actions would that imply? And that's the show for today. Thanks very much for listening. Y'all see you tomorrow here on LRN.FM.